Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. David is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. If you appreciate what David's doing, please email him and let him know. It's David at askelm.com. David at askelm.com. Go to the website. It's askelm.com. And we are now beginning file number 22 in our series of 101 Bible Secrets. You can read this book online for free at the askelm.com website. And today, I believe we're starting in appendix number 5, Where is the Lake of Fire? I'm getting better at this, David. I've been doing it now 22 times.
We'll be done by the time. We'll be perfect by the time we finish.
Oh, boy. And then on to other things. Yeah. Okay. What is it about this lake of fire? I've heard also, in addition to what you're talking about tonight, that the lake of fire could be considered the sun. So you take it from there.
Well, that I hadn't heard, and when you told me that, I was somewhat surprised. But actually, in the Bible, it can be shown that from the Bible and history, that the lake of fire is presently in existence on Earth. So that would tend to diminish the idea that it's the sun.
Yeah.
Although, you know, people have to prove it from the Bible and decide for themselves. At the present moment, the lake of fire is within one of its quiet periods, and fire is not now observed within the lake, but it is destined to erupt again before the second advent of Christ.
Okay, question.
Mm-hmm.
If this lake erupts again, and being that it has erupted in the past, and people used to walk for miles to go down and watch it, like a big movie event in those days, would it be out of the question to think there might be oil there?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely naphtha. And I've always been surprised. If they're going to look for oil in Israel, why not just make a deal with the Jordanians and put a big honking oil drilling rig right in the middle of the Dead Sea, which is where the Lake of Fire is. I don't want to, you know, spoil the surprise, but that's where the Lake of Fire is. Because everything is in relationship to Jerusalem in terms of prophecy. The Lake of Fire is not a volcano in South America.
Right.
It has a relationship to Scripture. And, of course, what I'm doing is we're reading the book of Dr. Martin, in appendix number 5, Where is the Lake of Fire, from the book 101 Bible Secrets. But the Lake of Fire was long ago, in history, known for its sulfuric and fiery eruptions in times in the past when God chose to judge sinners for their ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from Revelation chapter 19 and 20, it will be used in the future to judge the wicked. And death and Hades are destined to be thrown into the lake of fire. This is in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 14. The early Jewish theologians knew that this lake was a place of judgment, and they mention it in their ancient records. And if you want to look that up, you can go to Lightfoot's work called Works on Hebrew and the Talmud, volume 1, pages 15 and 16. Now, in this appendix, Dr. Martin will give the scriptural and historical information that's needed to identify this lake of fire. But what's interesting is the fact that you could go there now and see it with your own eyes and come away without experiencing any of the heat rather than that of the sunburn, which is, of course, very hot in that region. The lake of fire is on Earth today, and we're going to cover that to identify its location. The New Testament mentions the existence of the lake of fire, which is destined to become the place of judgment for the beast, the false prophet, Satan, after the millennium, and wicked human beings. It's called the lake of fire, or more accurately, the lake of the fire, because there's the definite article in the Greek. It is the fire which is found in the lake that makes the lake unique. That fire is the fire of judgment. The fuel that feeds the fire in this lake is brimstone. This is an old name for sulfur. And sulfur, of course, would be valuable too, even if there wouldn't be any oil to be found. Now, is there a lake on Earth today that fits the description of this lake of fire? And the answer is yes. In fact, this lake has been in existence for at least 4,000 years. People have traveled to its region and have reported seeing fire and columns of smoke ascending from its central sections. Such eyewitness reports have been given from earliest times. They have also testified to the presence of sulfurous fumes coming from the lake, and one scientist in our modern era has observed the hue of absinthe, the wormwood, which is spoken of in Revelation chapter 8 and verse 11,
right,
hovering over the lake on occasion. So where is this biblical lake located? Well, it's not difficult to discover its whereabouts if one will pay attention to some of the identifying factors associated with the lake. Now, let's consider some of these points. The first matter to consider is what constitutes a lake as humans are able to perceive it.
Yeah.
Well, the dictionary defines a lake as an area of depression in the earth which contains a liquid, which is normally water. It always has higher ground surrounding it, and in the case of ordinary lakes, it represents the central area of a drainage region into which streams and or rivers flow. Since the Apostle John in the book of Revelation used the ordinary and simple term for the word for lake, it could be reasonably believed that he had a conventional lake in mind, although he said it was, quote, the lake of the fire. Now, the definite article qualifies the word fire, the definite article in the Greek. The Apostle John was referring to a lake that had the fire within it, which was reserved for God's judgment. Secondly, this particular lake had fire associated with it that was fueled by sulfur. In some way, that chemical must be found in its midst. Third, John tells us that the lake will be in existence and active with fire just prior to the millennium, to the beginning of the millennium. This is in Revelation chapter 19, verse 20.
We're not there yet.
Not there yet.
Right.
Now, this means that it will be fully in evidence before the second advent of Christ to this earth. So this is if you accept this, this is another indicator that when you see this occurring, that means that we've passed another milestone toward the second coming of Christ.
Whoa.
Now, fourthly, the beast and the false prophet who fight against Christ at his advent will be thrown into this lake. Since it's made clear in the Bible that the final battles to be fought just prior to the millennium will be at or around Jerusalem, it could be reasonably have trouble with that word.
Yeah.
It could reasonably be suggested that the lake could be located in the same vicinity of the Jerusalem area. Indeed, it's plainly shown that the wicked will be tormented with fire and brimstone, quote, in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends up for the ages of the ages, which means for the aeon of the aeons. It just means more than one aeon.
Right.
And they have no rest day or night. And this is in Revelation chapter 14, verses 10 and 11. And it doesn't mean forever and ever. You just see the Greek. This is an exact reference to Isaiah 34, chapter 34, verses 8 to 10. Quote, For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of recompense for the controversy of Zion. And the streams of Edom, which, well, basically it's around the area of Jordan. The streams, meaning of Edom, mentioned earlier in Isaiah 34, shall be turned into pitch, and the dust into brimstone, and the land, meaning the land of Edom, shall become burning pitch, and it shall not be quenched day and night, day or night.
Yeah.
The smoke shall go up for the age, not forever, you know, as the King James says, but for the age. From generation to generation it shall lie waste, end quote. Isaiah 34, verses 8 to 10. This burning of Edom, an area that borders on the south, southern and southeastern portions of the Dead Sea, contained by Jordan at the present time, this burning of Edom occurs when, quote, the host of heaven shall be dissolved and the heavens shall be rolled together like a scroll. This is Isaiah 34, verse 4. Just like the book of Revelation says will happen at the second advent of Christ, in Revelation chapter 6, verse 14. This region of Edom will have stream beds flowing with rivers of fire. Now this pitch and brimstone will flow into the Dead Sea, located just east and south of Jerusalem.
It sounds like a volcano.
Yeah. This is all part of the earthquake that splits the Mount of Olives.
Right.
All this stuff's going to happen at the same time.
Oh, goodness.
Now, since this judgment takes place so near Jerusalem, it could be reasoned that the lake of fire was certainly in the vicinity. There's also a fifth point. John says that the lake has the factor of death associated with it. The lake of, quote, the lake of fire is the second death, and unquote. And this is where Hades and, or hell in English, Hades and death are to be cast. This is in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 14. Hades and death are the proper names of angelic powers who control these areas and conditions of judgment. This reference shows that, quote, the lake of fire cannot be a symbol of the ordinary grave because Hades is an angelic power who is actually thrown into it. So there's an angel out there with the name Hades associated with him. And there's also another angel with the name Death assigned to him. Whether that's the death angel that, did the killing at, we don't know.
Could that be Asmodeus?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
That information would come from non-biblical sources, so could be correct. I don't know.
Okay.
I usually don't get into that kind of stuff because I find it difficult to nail down myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, now sixthly, the lake cannot be Gehenna, which is another name for hell in the King James Version. The area of Gehenna, sometimes called Tophet, is a valley located on the southern edges of Jerusalem. In no way can the Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna, be considered a lake. It's a valley. It's not the bottomless pit, or in Greek, the abyss, because that is a pit in the earth with a door that a key can open. And this is in Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Now, admittedly, the description of the abyss is figurative, but it's not suitable to connect a door and a key with an entrance into a lake. So, you know, although this is an arguable point, I don't disagree with Dr. Martin, but, you know, perhaps if somebody can come up with more information on this, that's fine. Remember that the creatures which are released from the Euphrates are also released with a key.
Yeah.
They are unlocked and released. So there's a lot of stuff going on underneath in the area of Iraq right now.
Oh,
and
yes.
Who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if there are competing groups trying to keep the lid on stuff over there.
Yeah.
Most of whom don't have a clue of what they're doing.
You're right.
Even those that are involved with the supernatural don't even have a clue, even though they think they do. The Bible is the final arbiter on all of those things, and everybody else believes the lies that they're told by whatever they come in contact with. Right. Now, a final factor to consider is John's teaching that this lake of the fire will cease after the Great White Throne period. So it has a beginning where it will catch fire again, and then it will end after the Great White Throne, which occurs after the millennium, the period of time after the millennium. Now, this is because John says that, quote, the former things, meaning including the lake of the fire, the former things are passed away. Behold, I make all things new. And this is in Revelation chapter 21, verses 4 and 5. The area in which this lake is found will one day be healed and made new. Now, interestingly, there are some important scriptures that speak of a prominent lake being healed when the periods of God's judgment are completed. So these seven factors that we just went through are not of themselves sufficient for us to identify the lake, but it gives us some excellent clues which can become significant when we look at other scriptures and a number of other historical indications.
Right.
Now, we come to a major key to identify the lake of fire. There is a prime New Testament reference which goes a long way to solving the identification of the lake of fire. And it's found in the book of Jude. This New Testament writer was the brother of James and the half-brother of our Lord Jesus. He said that there was, in his time, an example of eternal fire, or age-lasting fire, that was an active and present witness to what the judgment of God would be like in the future. That example was the geographical area where the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah once existed. Jude called attention to the ruined condition of that region, as well as the fire that was still burning at the locale in Jude's day. That's right. The area around the ancient cities of Sodom and Gomorrah was still having fires and smoke in the time of Jude. Notice carefully what Jude said on the matter. This is in Jude verse 7. Quote, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication or promiscuity and going over to strange flesh, are set forth, in other words, this is present tense, are presently set forth for an example, suffering, they're presently suffering, the vengeance of age-lasting fire. This is in Jude 7. It does not say eternal fire because the fires have long gone out. So that they last for an age can be a short period of time or a long period of time. And if you see, you have to look at the Greek for the proper understanding of this passage to understand the present tense and the aspect of aeon or age. So when one looks at this verse closely, it tells us very much about the environment around the Dead Sea as it existed in the time of Jude. There were then active fires and smoke in the area. Strabo, the first century geographer, described the neighborhood as, quote, a land of fires, end quote. And this is in Strabo's geography, book 16, number 764. Some of the fires were fed by the seepage of naphtha, an old name for petroleum, bitumen, and other gaseous fumes. 100 years before Strabo, there is the record of a Jewish author who describes the Dead Sea area. And this is from the Wisdom of Solomon, a pseudepigraphal book written about 100 years before Strabo. Quote, wisdom saved a man, meaning Lot, from a destruction of the godless, and he escaped the fire that came on the five cities, cities whose wickedness is still attested by a smoking waste, end quote. Wisdom of Solomon 10:7. Now, this historical biblical reference indicates the Dead Sea region was then, at the time of composition of the Wisdom of Solomon, at the time of composition of Strabo's geography, as well as the composition of Jude, they were still smoking from subterranean fires. The Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, Siculus, S-I-C-U-L-U-S, Siculus, Diodorus Siculus, who also lived in the first century B.C., said, quote, "The fire which burns beneath the ground and the stench render the inhabitants of the neighboring country sickly and very short-lived," end quote. This is in Diodorus Siculus, Histories, Book 2, number 48. A few years later, in the time of Christ's childhood, the Jewish writer Philo gave witness to the burnings and the smoke. Now, Philo lived in Alexandria, but he apparently had traveled to Palestine. He gave witness to the burnings and smoke that were still ascending in his day. Quote, "The fire is most difficult to extinguish and creeps on pervading everything and smoldering. And a most evident proof of this is to be found in what is seen to this day, for the smoke which is still emitted and the brimstone that men dig up there." This is in his work on Abraham, chapter 27. "This fire and smoke was also seen in the midst of the Dead Sea as well. The geographer Strabo called the Dead Sea a lake, as did Josephus, the early Jewish historian, in Wars of the Jews, Book 4, passage 8 and 4.
You know, David, let me interject something here. Noah Kramer, who did a lot of translating of the Sumerian material,
mm-hmm.
There's a part in one of his books on that that talks about the people of those days mentioning an evil air that came and killed people. And I'm just wondering if it could have some connection with what we're talking about here. This. Fire. Yeah.
I've been there. I've swum in the Dead Sea, and it does smell. You can definitely smell the rotten eggs.
Yeah.
And you know, it also produces a very beneficial mud.
Yes.
However.
It's full of minerals.
Yeah, absolutely. And they sell it in at least. Out west here, they sell it in kiosks and in shopping centers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I swum in the Dead Sea, and you do float very well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a remarkable place. I mean, and there are organisms, single-cell organisms, that apparently do live in the northern portion where the Jordan River comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's how they got their goods for Qumran, which is right there, very close to the shore.
Yeah.
They just brought the goods and services, probably on water, although they did have cisterns, right down the Jordan River and across the Dead Sea, right to the shore there. That's how they got their fruits and vegetables at Qumran.
Well, the fumes from this thing has probably been seeping up now and then for thousands of years.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And absolutely. But the winds are primarily from the west to the east across the lake. So that's why Qumran was able to flourish for apparently quite a long time there. And, you know, the people, it flourished for quite a while, apparently. The structures that are there were long-term. They've dug down several levels.
Mm-hmm.
So it existed for several hundred years at that spot. Likewise at Masada, which was a fortress of King Herod that King Herod built. That was quite a remarkable place too. But that was also to the east. It's in the southeast of the Dead Sea. That was also the west, on the western shore, very up high, And once again, the prevailing westerlies would not blow the noxious fumes from the lake very often to that location. So, you know, things did work out if the winds are right.
Yes. Yeah.
But you're right. Too much of that stuff is obviously noxious,
like
the historical sources say.
Yeah, and they even, some of the translations that Noah Kramer did, it mentioned, you know, animals falling dead in their stalls, that it was an evil wind that came. You know, something that was in the wind that came.
Mm-hmm.
And I can imagine that there'd be a lot of poisonous fumes that could come out of that.
Yeah, and the smell is exactly like what you have, what they put in the United States in natural gas, so that you can detect it. They put the smell of rotten eggs in it on purpose. And that's exactly what it smells like by the Dead Sea. You get used to it, just like you do any smells. God's given us the ability to, for some reason, our smell perceptors get deadened fairly quickly so that we can, handle smells pretty well after a while. Josephus describes in his day, quote, in the midst of the lake is the source of the fire, and also there are great quantities of asphalt in the middle. The eruption is uncertain because the movements of fire have no known order to us, as it is of many other bases. Josephus continues, quote, together with the asphalt, there arises a great deal of soot, smoke, and apparently gases,
right,
invisible to the sight, by which brass, silver, and everything shiny, even gold, is tarnished. Now, around the area were, quote, drops of pitch distilling from the rocks and boiling streams, end quote. Quote, Strabo writes in his book 6, 764, quote, the lake was formed by earthquakes and boiling outbursts of fire and hot water impregnated with bitumen and brimstone, which was sulfur, end quote. Now, it's interesting to note that the eruptions of fire, smoke, and asphalt were not of a continuous duration. You know, they would stop and start, and start up and stop and then start again. Only at irregular times did such phenomena occur, but the occasions were frequent enough that eyewitnesses around the time of Christ and the apostles called it a lake of fire and smoke. In actual fact, we are told by Henry Maundrell, who traveled from Europe to Palestine in the year 1697 of our current era, that most of the mapmakers prior to the 17th century show smoke ascending from above the surface of the water, end quote. And this is in Maundrell's book Journey, page 454, in the Bone edition, B-O-H-N. Bone edition. However, when Maundrell visited the area in 1697, he didn't see any smoke. And yet the explorer Volney in 1787, 230 years ago, he was told that smoke periodically could be observed coming out of the Dead Sea. Now that lake is watched very carefully by geologists and environmentalists because the level of the lake is decreasing so much.
Well, isn't there a company that's trying to drill for oil over there?
There is, but they're not drilling near the Dead Sea.
Yeah, see, they're digging in the wrong spot.
It seems to me you go where the stuff is, but maybe because they know it's so volatile, they don't want to drill there. I don't know. Or they might feel they might trigger something, which is, possible too. But the Dead Sea is actually decreasing in size because agricultural needs of the Israelis and also the West Bank but primarily the Israelis. They're drawing water from the Jordan River so that less and less water is going into the Dead Sea. The water that's there now evaporates, and the level has gone down dozens and dozens of feet. Now, Volney in 1787 said, quote, in his book Travels, Volume 1, pages 281 and 282, quote, the south of Syria, that is the hollow through which the Jordan River flows, is a country of volcanoes. The bituminous and sulfurous sources of Lake Asphaltus, which is the Dead Sea, the lava, the pumice stones thrown up upon its banks, and the hot baths of Tiberias demonstrate that this valley has been the seat of subterranean fire, which is not yet extinguished. Clouds of smoke are often observed to issue from the lake and the new crevices to be formed upon its banks, end quote. So now, you know, this thing's been quiet just about ever since this time.
Yeah.
And Volney was a very astute observer, and he customarily inquired of the inhabitants about the characteristics of the lands that he visited. It seems, then, that as late as the 18th century, we're talking about the time of Napoleon, there were still some rare outbursts of smoke and fire coming from the middle of the Dead Sea. And, you know, like all things that have continued for a long time, uniformitarians tend to think, well, you know, to think that that ever really had fire in it. Well, the eyewitnesses say so. Eyewitnesses through a long process of history, not just some imaginings of the Apostle John about a lake of fire. A lot of people have said that this lake has smoke and fire coming from it. Reasonable observers. There have been no actual reporting since that time to Dr. Martin's knowledge, as he writes. It is true, however, that after major earthquakes, a great deal of asphalt has broken up in the bottom of the lake and risen to the surface. If you've ever been to the California coast, if you're down near where some of the oil wells are at some of the beaches, occasionally they will have oil which will loosen itself and come to the top, and it will float. And if you ever step on one of those tar things, it's very difficult to get it off. It takes a long time. We had our kids step in one of those things, and of course, after we got mad.
Yeah, after you get mad, I know.
Why did you do that? That's so much work. You have no idea. That then you deal with it, but it does take, and the kid thinks that, you know, his skin off his foot is going to be scraped off, but
yeah.
It just, you know, you can't step anywhere because it's just, you know, don't step on the carpet of the car.
Oh, really?
So, you know, this stuff happens in the Dead Sea. It just floats to the surface. The lake itself has been seemingly rather quiet over the past 200 years, and it has not erupted as formally described by those who live near the time of Christ. The first scientific investigation of the Dead Sea was by a scientist by the name of Lynch in 1848, and he recounted that there was, quote, a strong smell of sulfuric hydrogen, end quote, a, quote, fetid sulfurous odor in the night. The north wind was quite fresh and accompanied with the smell, with a smell of sulfur, end quote. And this is the journal of, R period sociology, I don't know what the R stands for, Journal of the Royal Society, that's what it is, volume 18, page 127. Interestingly, this is the very description of some of the factors comprising, quote, the lake of fire and brimstone, end quote, or sulfur in the Book of Revelation. But of course, there was no literal smoke seen by Lynch that he could have no doubt vouched for. But he did, on one occasion, report a strange phenomena that happened. At one time, there appeared to be smoke coming from the center, though Lynch attributed it to an illusion, but note what he said. He said, at one time today, the sea assumed an aspect peculiarly somber. The great evaporation enveloped it in a thin, transparent vapor. Its purple tinge contrasted strangely with the extraordinary color of the sea beneath, and where they blended in the distance, giving it the appearance of smoke from burning sulfur. It seemed a vast cauldron of metal, fused but motionless. In the afternoon of the same day, it looked like molten lead. At night, it had the exact hue of absinthe or wormwood. And this is in J.R. Journal of the Royal Geographical or Geological Society. Pages 276 to 324. Now, in the book of Revelation, absinthe is called wormwood in Revelation chapter 8, verse 11,
right,
which caused waters to become bitter. What the explorer Lynch observed is very interesting. The scene gives the impression of smoke from burning sulfur ascending above the surface of the Dead Sea, while parts of the lake gave the appearance of a vast cauldron of molten lead. Now, is this illusory occurrence seen by Lynch what the ancients were talking about? Well, perhaps in part, Dr. Martin says, but there is simply too much evidence from competent observers of the past to dismiss all of the eyewitness accounts as illusionary. Indeed, only at certain times in the past did the lake erupt in its fiery display. And for the last 200 years, and maybe much longer, the lake has been relatively inactive. The prophecies, however, suggest, as we will show later, that a new and more violent eruption of sulfurous fire and smoke is destined to emerge from the lake and the surrounding areas, and that the, quote, lake of fire, end quote, mentioned in Book of Revelation, will be very much active at the time of Christ's second advent to this earth. Such a possibility should surprise none of us moderns, because we have all witnessed the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State,
oh, yeah,
which is about 50 miles from where Dr. Martin lived in Portland, Oregon, and it's about 50 miles from where I live right now. The Dead Sea area may well be getting ready for a renewal of its fiery activity. There are yet a few years before this will occur. In fact, it will happen at an exact time in prophetic history. Now, the Lake of Fire is the Dead Sea. We will now show biblical evidence that the Dead Sea is the prophesied Lake of Fire. Now, recall that Jude said that the area of Sodom and Gomorrah was at a present example in Jude's time to the eternal or age-lasting fire that God has designed for the punishment of the wicked. This is in Jude verse 7. The Bible tells us that in those cities of which Jude spoke are now under the Dead Sea. The former valley of Siddim, in which Sodom and Gomorrah were situated, quote, is the Salt Sea. And this is in Genesis chapter 14, verse 3.
Wow.
Now, these cities were positioned in the northern part of where the Dead Sea now is. They were not in the southern part of the lake. This is made plain in the biblical revelation. Abraham and Lot looked over Sodom and Gomorrah from the site of Bethel, located a short distance north of Jerusalem. In no way would it have been possible for Abraham and Lot to have seen the southern part of the lake from Bethel. The Bible, on the other hand, makes the clear statement that these two cities were east of Bethel. And this is in Genesis chapter 13, verse 11, not south by east. And it could be seen. Even the biblical description of the four northern kings attacking Sodom and Gomorrah show the kings circling the valley of Siddim on the east and then south, and finally attacking Hazazon Tamar, or En Gedi, now halfway up the western slope of the Dead Sea, before they encountered the king of Sodom. This is in Genesis chapter 14, verses 7 and 8. This again shows that Sodom and Gomorrah lay in the northern regions of the Dead Sea. We are also told that the wilderness of Zeboim, which is a near spelling of Zeboim, a neighbor city of Sodom, was directly east of Beth Horon and Bethel. This is found in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 18. This also leads one from Bethel eastward toward Jericho. All of these geographical indications direct us to the northern parts around the Dead Sea, not the south. The northern half of the lake is its deepest part. Its surface is about 1,300 feet below sea level, below normal sea level, and soundings have been made in its northern sector of another 1,300 feet to reach its bottom. So, the northern sector is 1,300 feet deep from the surface of the water, and the surface of the water is 1,300 feet deep from the sea level. So the bottom of the Dead Sea goes 2,600 feet, half a mile, from sea level.
You mean below sea level?
Below sea level, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's considerably deeper than the Death Valley in California.
Yeah.
It's truly the lowest area on Earth below normal sea level. And I didn't notice any difference in pressure, air pressure, when we were there. I suppose there is, but because 1,300 feet would make a difference as you increase the pressure. The Dead Sea is part of what is called the Jordan Rift. Now, the Jordan Rift is a great depression or fault line in the earth that starts north of Mount Hermon and continues southerly with the Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee, and the Dead Sea in its nether regions. The rift continues south to the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea, into Africa and ends up near the source of the Nile River. It is the longest known fault line on Earth. From satellite pictures, it is a very prominent feature on the surface of the Earth and very well distinguished from other land formations. In other words, you can see it from space. It's so big.
Yeah.
Now, the chasm of the Jordan is the example of punishment. There is a reason why Jude centered his example of future punishment on the ancient area of Sodom and Gomorrah. To him, the Dead Sea, with its sulfurous smoke and fiery characteristics, was the perfect exemplar given by God for his vengeance upon evil angels and wicked humans. He could simply point to the smoldering cauldron of the Dead Sea and tell the rebellious people that they would finally experience the ravages of that lake of fire when it burst forth in a final and catastrophic eruption at the end of the age. Jude could also point to historical examples to substantiate his prophetic beliefs. His prototypes of punishment were recorded in the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. In fact, Jude's reference to judgment went back before the flood of Noah. Enoch, the great-grandfather of Noah, was a prophet who foretold even the second advent of Christ. This is in Jude verse 14. Enoch was also a prophet who gave many warnings of judgment. He even foretold the exact year of the occurrence of the flood of Noah. And this is covered in question 54, if you want to go back to that, to look at that, in the 101 Bible Secrets. Now, this may be all fine and good, but what does this do with the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, which was an example of the end-time vengeance of God? Well, it has very much to do with it. One should pay careful attention to the fact that Noah, the man who was saved through the flood, was the 10th generation from Adam, as we have it listed in Genesis chapter 5. God gave the pre-flood world exactly 10 generations before their judgment came. The fact that the flood happened in the 10th generation from creation is very important to early biblical interpreters. This is because Enoch, according to Jude, also prophesied of the second judgment to occur on earth when the Lord would appear from heaven with 10,000 of his saints. And this is in Jude verses 14 to 16. This particular judgment was to be with fire, not with water. Moreover, God promised that no more universal judgment would come through the use of water, and this was said after the flood in Genesis chapter 8, verses 21 and 22. When one compares later prophecies of the Bible, one against another, the next adjudication was to arrive on earth in the form of fire and brimstone. In ancient times, it became popular to view history and prophecy in a cyclical fashion. This is from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9. Things reoccur. Now, it's important to note that Noah was the 10th generation from Adam. Right. The first was Adam, then Seth. Third was Enosh. Fourth was Canaan. Fifth was Mahalalel. Sixth was Jared. Seventh was Enoch. Eighth was Methuselah. Ninth was Lamech. And the 10th was finally Noah, in whose time the flood destroyed the world. Now note the next generation to follow Noah after the flood. In other words, the next 10 generations to follow Noah after the flood. There was Shem first, then second Arphaxad, third was Salah, fourth was Eber, fifth was Peleg, sixth was Reu, seventh was Sureg, eighth was Nahor, ninth was Terah, and the 10th was Abraham. The 10th generation from the watery destruction in the time of Noah was Abraham. With Noah, God began a new creation in a physical way. He created the people, that eventually became the people of Israel,
right,
through Abraham.
Right.
Abraham was the 10th generation individual. God began a new spiritual creation. He began to use a man who would produce a nation of people, Israel, from whom would come the Messiah to rescue people from all the judgments of God and bring them into a perfect salvation. This was accomplished through the efforts of Christ. But God also did something else in the time of Abraham that was a repeat of what happened in the time of Noah. A further judgment against Noah, against rebellion, a further judgment against rebellion and sin also took place in that 10th generation, just as one took place in Noah's 10th generation. Now, God did not bring the later destruction by water, but it was by fire. This was at the time that fire and brimstone fell on Sodom and Gomorrah and the Valley of Siddim. So thorough was the devastation that the fire within the Jordan Valley appeared as though it was a complete destruction of the earth by the burning of fire. That opinion was certainly expressed by Lot's daughters. Quote, "There is not a man in the earth," in other words, end quote, was their appraisal. In other words, there's not a man left in the earth. So, in Genesis 19:31, they thought that the world had come to an end by the fire and brimstone, that there was not a man left in all the earth except their father Lot. After all, it was the 10th generation from Noah, and they knew that their father was a righteous man, comparatively, and that he was saved specifically from the destruction. What a surprise to the girls when they discovered that only the Jordan Rift Valley was destroyed. It was a great enough devastation, however, that it became the example of the future judgment when God will rain down a fiery rebuke on rebellious men at the end of the age. Now, you talk about rebellious men. The men have, you know, human beings are not judged generally unless they know what they're rebelling against.
Yeah, they know right from wrong. Yeah.
And most people don't know God and they don't know right from wrong,
right,
except as enforced by government. But it's not, their rebellion is not any rebellion that men have today is not directed toward God. But God will make himself known before the judgment sufficiently, in my view, that he will be totally righteous in judging people for what they know. That means we're going to have a lot of information put out in the world from God that will be recognized as being from God. And this, I believe, is part of the restitution of all things that Peter talks about in the book of Acts.
Right.
In order to warn men of this future judgment, Jude saw the Jordan Valley as a contemporary example of a bursting forth of periodic flames of sulfurous origin, with columns of smoke coming from the surrounding land and the lake. It was a further admonition of what would occur at the end of the age, only this time with even more intensity than occurred at the time of Lot. This is why Jude placed the example of God's judgment for the future directly into the Jordan Rift Valley at this time, right to the area of the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea was once the Lake of Fire, and it is destined again to become that same Lake of Fire at the time of Christ's second advent. It is soon to erupt, probably in its north end, with a fiery display that will be, well, truly awesome. And we should briefly remind ourselves of the parable given by Christ about Lazarus and the rich man. The locale of that story is precisely in the area of the Jordan Rift Valley and the northern region of the Dead Sea. This is in Luke chapter 16, verses 19 to 31. Here was the rich man after death in the place of fire. Now, this is all figurative and this is a parable, but still, the geographical locations were recognizable to the people that Jesus was giving the parable to.
Right.
They fully understood what the area that he was talking about. It's in the Jordan Rift Valley and the northern region of the Dead Sea. Here was the rich man after death in the place of fire. He looked and saw Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham. Between Abraham and the rich man was a, quote, great gulf fixed. This is in Luke 16, verse 26. And as we've discussed in question number 41, that the great gulf of Christ's parable was clearly the Jordan Rift Valley. The rich man was east of the Jordan River, and Lazarus and Abraham were west of it. The latter two were inheriting the promises of the land of Palestine given to Abraham. But the rich man was outside of the promised land. He was not allowed to enter. He had to remain in the region of the fires near the northern edge of the Dead Sea, but east of the Jordan River. This was an area where there once were continual and unrelenting flames, and they existed in the time of Christ, enough that people easily understood the examples that Jesus was talking about in the parable. The significance of the parable, and that's what it was, a parable, not an actual occurrence, was to show that the region of the Great Gulf was a place of punishment. It was directly in the same location that Jude placed the example of eternal, or better, age-lasting fire to try the wicked. And this is in Jude chapter 7. Now, the Valley of Hinnom. With the information that the great chasm or gulf of the Jordan Rift with the smoking Dead Sea in its midst is the place of punishment for the wicked, we can now understand much better the position of Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom near Jerusalem, in this scheme of future punishment. Christ frequently referred to Gehenna as a place of fiery judgment. This is in Matthew 5, verses 22, 29, and 30. Matthew 10, verse 28. Mark, chapter 9, verse 47. Luke, chapter 12, and verse 5, etc. There's other verses. This particular valley of Hinnom was situated outside the southern walls of Jerusalem. It was a place where the fires to the pagan god Moloch were sanctified. And they frequently did the sacrifices by the tombs of the kings and then took them to be sanctified and burned down in the Valley of Hinnom. And this is in Jeremiah 32, verse 35, and Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 31. It was called Tophet. Quote, "For Tophet is ordained of old, yea, for the king," meaning the evil king, perhaps the Antichrist. "It is prepared. He hath made it deep and large. The pile thereof is fire and much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, does kindle it." This is an Isaiah, end quote, Isaiah chapter 30, verse 33. Valley of Hinnom is the prison where some of the, quote, high ones, angels, and kings on the earth will be incarcerated. Within the stretch of its confines is a very deep pit, a bottomless pit, and it is the place of containment for evil angels and finally for Satan during the millennium. This is in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. And we'll see in a moment that indications show that this pit of imprisonment, the abyss, is associated with the Valley of Hinnom, the Tophet. The Valley of Hinnom commenced at Jerusalem and journeyed eastward at a precipitous rate until it empties into the northern parts of the Dead Sea. The watercourse is known to this day as the Wadi An-Nar. In Arabic, it means the stream bed of fire. And by the way, I know a friend of mine, Professor George Wesley Buchanan, he said that he's walked that path a couple times all the way, when he was younger, all the way from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea. This Valley of Hinnom, that is the Gehenna mentioned by Christ, is about 15 miles long. It plummets into the Dead Sea, the lake which is the Lake of Fire. This means that Gehenna and the Lake of Fire were typically connected. The ceremony of the scapegoat, the Azazel goat, on the Day of Atonement was part of this typical story from Leviticus, and this is found in Leviticus chapter 16. Two goats were selected. One was to be sacrificed in Jerusalem, while the other was to be taken by an able-bodied man into the wilderness east of Jerusalem. Now, indeed, the scapegoat was to be taken down the Valley of Hinnom to a place about 3 miles east and south of Jerusalem called Beth Chaduda, where the goat was allowed to go over a very steep cliff like an abyss, so that he could never come in contact with civilization again. And he was actually released. Now, this is in Babylonian Talmud, Yoma 67b, and Targum Jerusalem, Leviticus 14:10. Now, this part of the wilderness was where the demons were supposed to be. It's near this region where Christ was tempted of the devil in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 to 11. The place was part of the drainage system of the Wadi An-Nar, the extension of the Gehenna, the stream bed of fire. From this area, the stream bed of fire ran directly eastwards into the Dead Sea, which is the Lake of Fire. The stream of fire flows into the Lake of Fire. The place was a part of the drainage system of the Wadi An-Nar. From this area, the stream bed of fire ran eastwards into the Dead Sea. This region between Beth Chaduda and the Dead Sea contained the abyss mentioned in the book of Revelation. It will be a place of temporary confinement of Satan and his angelic powers for the millennium. Quote, "And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, the abyss, and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon," just like the fit man in Leviticus chapter 16, verse 21, led the scapegoat. "The dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the abyss, and shut him up," in other words, away from mankind and civilization, "and set a seal on him, that he should deceive the nations no more, until the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, After that, he must be loosed for a little season. End quote. This is Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. The place that the Azazel goat, the scapegoat, was taken in the ritual of the Day of Atonement is where Satan will be kept for the millennium. You can go there today and walk down there. It's a very long walk, and it's very difficult, and it's very steep, but it's possible to be, you know, very easy. It's possible to do it. Now, it's also the place where Christ defeated Satan during his 40 days of temptation. And everything fits perfectly in this prophetic scenario. And I think we should probably stop for time reasons and split this into another into another show. So thank you for the opportunity again, Jen.
This is really, really interesting. My goodness. Ah.
He knew his geography.
Yeah, he did. Wow. Everybody, this concludes file number 22A. We will do a second part. It'll be 22B. And go to askelm.com. Take a look at the materials there. As I said before, you can read this book, 101 Bible Secrets, for free online at askelm.com. And if you want to contact David Seeloff, use this email address, david@askelm.com. And as you know, we have a large archive of these audio files that David and I are doing, and we really appreciate the listeners out there and the feedback that we have been getting. Thank you, everybody, and God bless you for that. It's important that we know what the audience thinks, and it's been very nice reading such wonderful emails. Anyway, we have come to the end of this file. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff signing off for tonight. We will be back, God willing. And read your scriptures, study, pray. And God bless you, David Seeloff, for all the work that you're doing. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff. Signing off. Good night, everybody, and God bless you.